Welcome to Sabbatical 101. My name is Bethany Walensky, and I'm an associate professor at Michigan State University. I had a life-changing sabbatical, and I'm on a mission to help fellow academics do the same. This podcast is a resource for all things academic sabbaticals. Each episode will provide you with inspiration and insight into the sabbatical planning process, regardless of your institution, discipline, length of sabbatical, or where you plan to sabbatical. I'm so excited to have you along for the ride.
This episode is a conversation with Margaret Salee. Margaret is a professor of higher education at the University at Buffalo. She's taken two sabbaticals, one at home and one away with her two children. In this episode, we talk about Margaret's sabbaticals, and she shares insight and advice about taking a sabbatical away with kids. You'll find this episode helpful if you're considering taking a sabbatical away with kids, or if you're in the midst of planning one. Margaret shares her experience arranging all the logistics, housing, schools, visa, insurance, and all about what she and her daughters loved about their sabbatical. Margaret's sabbatical is also a great example of how to pivot and make the most of a sabbatical when things don't go as planned, both personally and professionally. I hope you enjoy the conversation. Hi, Margaret. Thanks so much for being on the show today.
No, I'm so happy to be here.
So before we dive into talking about your sabbatical, could you just introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about department and the focus of your research so we can contextualize your sabbatical story?
Absolutely. So my name is Margaret Salee. I use she, her pronouns. I am a professor of higher education at the University at Buffalo. And since returning from sabbatical, I've also become department chair. That's a different story for another time. But my research predominantly focuses on work-family issues in the academy. I look at how universities either help or hinder faculty, staff, and students with pursuing meaningful professional and personal lives.
So your research is actually pretty relevant to sabbatical taking, if we think about kind of the ways sabbaticals help us not only professionally, but also kind of personally to be kind of full people, hopefully.
Exactly. I like to think that anyway.
Yeah, that's what we all hope, right? And you just finished up your second sabbatical. And so I know that your first, you stayed home. And then for your second one, which just happened this past fall, you spent the semester in Cambridge in the UK. And you also have twin six-year-olds, right?
They just turned seven, but they were six when we were there.
Wow. Exciting time. So I would love to hear more about your sabbaticals, and I'll let you kind of take that in the direction that you choose. But I wonder if you would mind sharing kind of how you arrived at each of these sabbaticals. Like, how did you decide where you wanted to be and what you wanted to do on these different sabbaticals?
Yeah, absolutely. So yes, my first sabbatical was in fall 2017. When I applied for the sabbatical, I was not pregnant. And I've been trying to get pregnant for 2 years, honestly. It took me a very long time. And so I was still going to take the sabbatical, right? Because we get them so rarely, although we're very lucky. And so I was pregnant. I was 5 months pregnant with twins, but looked like I was 9 months pregnant with a singleton. And so I spent most of the time here in Buffalo working on research, but I did spend 3 weeks as a visiting faculty member at Simon Fraser University in Vancouver, which was great, right? So I collaborated with a colleague on some work the two of us were doing at the time on student parents at community colleges. And we used the time to work on papers, and I gave some guest lectures while I was there. And I also at the time wrote a book proposal for an edited book that ended up coming out. It was March 2020 when I was revising the introduction. So I always talked about it took longer to birth that book, right, than to birth my twins.
Yeah, it needed a slightly longer incubation period.
Exactly, exactly. So that was a very logistically practical sabbatical, right? What I was able to do physically and what I wanted to do. And it still fed my soul in a lot of different ways, even if my knees were buckling under the weight of twin pregnancy.
And how, I'm trying to do the math in my head, but how soon after, were they born right after your sabbatical ended?
They sure were. So they were born in January. Yeah, right after the fall. And yeah, so I went from sabbatical to a release from teaching for the next semester, which was helpful. Near the end of the semester, I was doing some work for the department because they couldn't have me step into a class part with her. But yes, so that was that sabbatical. which was very different from this most recent sabbatical.
Yeah. So this most recent sabbatical, so it's kind of, you can kind of map your sabbaticals to your daughter's ages, which is kind of cool, right? And to your point about taking the sabbatical, you know, you hadn't expected to be pregnant on sabbatical. I feel like there's value to taking sabbatical when you become eligible for it, because then that affects when you get your next sabbatical, assuming you get subsequent ones. So that would have been part of my calculation. I was like, I wanted to take my sabbatical as soon as I was eligible for it, no matter what.
Absolutely. A firm believer, you can do good thinking at any stage, right? Even if when you are wildly pregnant, I do advise perhaps not taking it right after you birth your children. It's a little harder with infants and newborns.
Yes, that would be more of a rest and recovery type of sabbatical, I think, especially with two. I barely managed with one at a time.
Yes, it was a lot.
Yeah. So now the girls were six when you headed off for your second sabbatical. So tell me about that one. How did you land in Cambridge? And yeah, what was the plan for that sabbatical?
Yes, the plan.
The plan. Well, then we'll talk about what actually happened.
Yeah. So I was invited. There's somebody who works at a university in Cambridge. It's called Anglia Ruskin University. It's not the famous University of Cambridge, right? But it's another well-known university in the town who also does similar research. And she invited me to come visit during my sabbatical when I mentioned that I had a sabbatical coming. And so that's what I did. I moved straight through and straightforward, headstrong to figuring out a way for us to go there. And it was, you and I will talk about, I had a different project also in mind in addition to working with her that did not work out, but I found other ways to use my time.
Okay. So the inspiration for going to Cambridge was this collaborator and the project that you were going to work on. Tell me a little bit, if you can remember, because I think we also tend to block these things out. Like, planning a sabbatical is so much work. Planning to move abroad with your family is a ton of work. So can you tell me a little bit about that? How did you put all the logistics in place?
It was a lot. You are right. So, and I think it's also important to mention that there's no other parent in this family. So it's just me and my two kids, which is both freeing, right? Because there was not another career to worry about, but, or another, you know, another person in that regard, but also then it's all on me. So I did start, we left in August and I started thinking about housing in January or February. And so I first, you know, I tried through the university. I tried all sorts of different things. Cambridge University actually has a very robust program of support for visiting faculty. So I tried to figure out, could I get it in with them and apply for their housing? And that went nowhere. And then I contacted the partner, the hosting university that doesn't do this sort of thing. And they said, good luck. And then I posted on a Facebook group, of all things. I joined a bunch of parenting groups for the town and said, you know, this isn't really parenting related, but I'm moving to Cambridge in autumn. And does anybody have a house to rent? And one person who was in the group said, you know, my mom Airbnbs her house and she's looking for a longer term tenant. And it was in that way that I connected with her. So it was really like shaking every possible tree to find something. And that's how it ended up working out.
Okay. And what about your house back in Buffalo? Did you rent that out?
I did. So I posted on sabbaticalhomes.com, got zero takers until, of course, after I had left.
Sure.
But I had spread the word through networks, and there is a friend of a friend who knew that there was a faculty member at my home institution who was a visiting faculty member, or he was a new hire and had negotiated to just be in Buffalo for fall for his first two years of hire. So he literally needed somewhere to live for 4 months, and it worked out really perfectly. He could use my car, which I think benefited him, and had my house. So he arrived a week after I left, and he left 2 weeks before I got home.
Oh, wow. That sounds perfect. That's a really, really good situation. So you found your housing in Cambridge, and then did your daughters attend the local public school?
Yes. So about finding schools in Cambridge was stressful because it was oversubscribed, because so many people have been leaving London and moving to Cambridge, especially post-pandemic, right? And so you have to apply for a spot, but you can't do that until you have housing. And that is what motivated me finding housing, right? So I did that in February, and then I could apply for housing in May. I'm trying to remember schools for May, but then you wouldn't hear until where you could go. And there is like a central person for the town of Cambridge, and I'm sure this is the case for anywhere in the UK, that will work with folks on sort of where your kids can get into school. And they basically told me, your neighborhood school is full. Don't even bother ranking them.
Oh, wow.
And I found a school online, like as a researcher, right? I did my research, and one of the schools was really like very pro-diversity and very inclusive. And I knew that's where I wanted my kids to be. So I ranked them first. We did not get in there. We got into another school that was about a mile plus away. And also, we didn't have a car. I knew we wouldn't have a car in Cambridge. And so everybody I talked to said it was also a great school. So we signed up. The staff was lovely. And then we heard back from the first school that there was space. And so I switched them back to that, my original school, which was good because it was closer to our house also. And so I knew that it would make for an easier.
And so how did you commute? Did you walk to school every day? Was there a bus? Did you have a bike?
We had bikes.
Okay.
We had bikes. So within the week of arriving, probably 2 or 3 days of arriving, we bought bikes. I actually had a friend who just finished a sabbatical there who sold me her bike when she left, and then we bought kids' bikes for the kids. And so we would bike to school, which those who have small children can probably relate to, like, it's terrifying biking with small children. Like, a look behind, like, one would just look back at me while we're biking along and swerving. And, you know, in Cambridge, they don't mess around. Like, we were biking next to double-decker buses.
Okay.
And so that, but all the drivers are very good, right? Mm-hmm. In terms of, like, they look out for kids. But it was, we grew a lot in our biking skills while we were there.
Yes. They are now more competent bikers than they were before.
Or that's right.
And so did you need a visa to go to the UK?
Okay. I sure did.
Oh, okay. I thought you were going to say no, but tell me about that. I was like, I thought if you go to the UK, you could avoid that drama.
My sense is that because they needed to go to, they needed the visas. Mm-hmm. I did not need the visa, but they needed the visas. And since it was very complicated with a series of rules for the UK, but because they were children of academic visitors, they were eligible to go to public school.
Okay.
And I, as a single parent, like I really couldn't have afforded to send them to private school, which would have been my only other option. So it was, you know, we didn't get their visas till 2 or 3 weeks before we left, and my visa too. So it was just this whole exercise of trusting in the universe that it would work out, right?
Yeah.
And that's just what you have to do.
And then after you give someone your passport, it will somehow return to your home address before you need to get on an airplane,
correct.
Right?
Correct. Exactly. Awesome. So we had to get a visa, went downtown in Buffalo to do that for them and for all of us. And it worked out. Yeah.
So what did your kids think about spending the semester away? How much were they involved in the planning? And then kind of what were they excited about? What were they nervous about?
So they're little still, yeah. Right? So they were involved in some planning, but like, not a lot, and certainly not executing any of the plans, I'll say
yes.
That much. but they, I mean, I think that they were nervous at first, right? So they were two when the lockdown happened, right? So I think like COVID shaped a lot of things for many people's childhoods. And I think that that sort of was challenging for them to think about, you know, what does that mean to go somewhere so different and to be out of their comfort zone?
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, when I told them we were going to England, I did it right before we were going to gymnastics because they love gymnastics. And I was like, great, I'll just tell them and then we'll go. But they cried for an hour.
Oh, sweet girls.
But I cheered them by telling them we would go to Disneyland Paris. And that is what seemed to get them excited. But they, you know, they are tremendous travelers now. They love it. And they have already asked, when are we going back? Like they've asked to go back this summer. And I've said, you know, mama can't quite afford that this summer, but let's plan for another summer. But they got very excited very quickly.
Yeah. That's so gratifying too. Isn't it so fun when you get to have that? I mean, you've only been home for a month or so, right? But then to have that kind of, oh, remember when we lived in Cambridge and remember we did this and those kinds of sweet, fun new memories you've built as a family.
Exactly.
That's so awesome.
Exactly. I just hope that they remember them, right? Because they're right at that transitional age. So, but we talk about it enough. And I do think that there are some really core memories for them right now.
Yeah. And I think even if they don't remember the details as they get older, it does, I guess, I mean, I'm not a developmental psychologist, but I would imagine that it shapes them, right? And they're kind of like the way they look at the world and the way they engage with it and other people. So you mentioned Disneyland Paris or Disney World Paris. Did you guys have any other fun family adventures while you were there?
We sure did. We went to Norway about 10 days after arriving. Because it had always been on my list to see the fjords. I fell off a train, though, when we were in Norway, and I tore a ligament in my knee. So that led to some challenges.
So that was like a week in or something?
It was.
Oh, my gosh.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I knew that you had a health problem, but I didn't know that it actually happened in Norway. So you got hurt in Norway. And what did you do?
I powered through like single parents do, right? Yeah. My sister-in-law is a nurse practitioner. So I called her on the phone and, you know, but nobody knew how bad it was. Like people just thought I like sprained something. And it was only when we got back to the UK where I went to the ER, what they call A&E, to get an x-ray. And that's when they discovered it was in fact a torn ligament.
So what did you have to do? Did you need surgery?
I did not. I was recommended for physical therapy, and I went once through the NHS, the National Health Service in the UK, and they said they wouldn't be able to see me for another 3 weeks. And so I actually reached out to my primary care in Buffalo, and I had access to online physical therapy through a US-based provider.
Okay.
And so I would meet with them once a week, and there was an app like there is for everything, right? That gave me exercises to do. And it was that really allowed me to recover. That and biking everywhere, honestly, like the biking was good for it. I couldn't walk very well for a month, but I could bike. So I was actually released from physical therapy the week before we left to come back to the US.
Oh my gosh. Mm-hmm. Wow. I have so many questions, but I guess the first is, so it sounds like you were able to access, hypothetically, you could have accessed some care through the NHS. Did you have travel insurance or like, tell me about insurance? Because I feel like in the US, we're always like, Europe is so much better, single payer system. But tell me about that as a visitor in a European country.
Well, I did not have travel insurance, which is my biggest regret. I did call my health provider before I left the US and said, if I get hurt, knowing me and my children, like, what is there anything that's covered? And they said, if you go to the ER, any ER that's covered, right? Mm-hmm. Like, and so I sort of thought to myself, why else would I need more than that?
What could possibly go wrong?
Exactly. So, and in fact, when I went for PT at the hospital, it was $80 for a 30-minute session with this guy, and I paid out of pocket. Mm. And they are very on it with having somebody call overseas visitors to get payment right away. But ironically, or, you know, terribly, a week and a half before we left, one of my kids fell off a play structure at the playground, and we also ended up at A&E for her. And I do not think I received a bill for her.
Huh.
And so sort of England's policy, and maybe somebody's now going to chase me down after this is out in the world, but like seems to be that they don't bill for your first presentation at the ER.
Okay. If you need follow-up care, best to have travel insurance, it sounds like.
Yes. I was very lucky, but when I have a sabbatical again, I will absolutely have travel insurance in case something like this happens again.
Yeah. That's good to know. Yeah. But was Norway fun despite the torn ligament, or was
it just amazing? I mean, it was so great. I love seeing cities by walking, right? So even after I fell, we walked 3 miles one day, you know, and my kids are complaining, and I'm pretty sure that was not great for my knee. But you know, we visited Bergen and Oslo and took a tour of the fjords. 10 out of 10, totally recommend. Yeah. So we did a week in Paris also, which a couple of days at Disneyland, but mostly in Paris. And then we took day trips to London and around. I studied abroad in England as an undergraduate. So I went back to where I studied in Norwich. And then we took a weekend trip to Glasgow.
Oh, that sounds wonderful.
It was great.
Yeah.
Super lucky we have these kinds of jobs that allow us to do things like this.
Yeah. And it's just so fun to, like I said before, I mean, we did a lot of traveling when I did a sabbatical in France with my kids. And it's just so cool to hear them talking about the places we went to and to feel like, you know, sometimes as parents, it's like, was that really worth it? And I feel like the sabbatical was 100% worth it.
Yeah, it's really special. And one of my kids came back with a British accent, which was adorably cute.
I love that. It doesn't take long, does it?
I know. And unfortunately, it's totally gone now, but it was so sweet. So I have recordings of that.
That's so sweet. I love that. For your daughters, how did the adjustment to school and making friends go? What was that like for them?
So they did great. I mean, so the school was different in that their classes were larger than they're used to here. Their class had 30 kids. And their classes here have 20. And I would say it's a little more British schools, you know, they start formal school at 4. So that it's a little more academically rigorous, but they also have way more recess than we do in the US. So the kids had an hour and a half of recess a day, which included lunch, but nonetheless, right? They had an hour and a half to move their bodies and they were happier kids there. Like one of my kids really needs to move their body a lot. And so that really allowed her to just get it out. But they made good friends. We were sort of scooped into a group of pre-existing friends who would invite us out for play dates and really just like our closest friends that we made were through their school.
Yeah, that's great. And you haven't been back long, but have your daughters been able to keep in touch with any friends?
We just got a card from one yesterday. And we are, you know, we're doing video calls with several other friends, which is just, it's lovely.
Yeah, that's so sweet. So great. So now to your experience during your sabbatical, so you had a collaborator in Cambridge and you guys had a project you were working on, and then you had another project you wanted to work on. So tell me a little bit about your goals for sabbatical and what came to fruition and what didn't, if that's even a valid question.
Sure is. My collaborator and I were going to do like a policy paper comparing policies in the US and the UK, and that's still ongoing. We're working on it. As I mentioned, and I do work on work family issues in the academy, and I've done a lot of studies of faculty work and staff work and sort of the changing conditions in a neoliberal context of what's going on and how that sort of shapes how we approach things. And I simultaneously have a lot of projects on student parents. And so I thought, I'm just going to lump them all into one study, right? And do a study of faculty, staff, and students in this neoliberal context. And so I reached out to IRB here, and they said, it's fine, no problem. You need to go through IRB. There may be some steps, and I'm a qualitative researcher, so that's also really critical to know. So there may need to be some steps that you take to anonymize some things. No problem. That's fine. So then I get to the UK. We go to Norway, have our vacation. It's fine. So it's early September, nursing this busted knee. And I reach out to our IRB and they say, hey, just kidding. You can't collect data. And
you can't collect data in the UK.
Correct.
Okay.
And I mean, it was far more nuanced than that, but basically, so the UK and Europe, right, have data protection laws that are far more strict than the US rules. And my university, and I have no problem saying it, has a very conservative approach to navigating GDPR, the privacy rules. It was suggested to me that I just do a quantitative survey and that should get me the data I want. And I let them know that was very offensive to suggest that. I had a meeting with the University Systems Legal Counsel, and it was then that I understood that it was his conservative approach that is basically squashing all research in the SUNY system in international contexts. So I've reached out to colleagues at universities around the country who are not having similar problems, that their universities have found ways around it. And I tried to shake the trees a little bit, but it just ultimately turned out not to be a good use of my energy if I knew I wasn't going to change anything. That's frustrating.
Yeah, right? What a surprise. That's unexpected.
It's unexpected and frankly unacceptable that I was told that I'm not told until I was there that it was going to be a problem.
Yeah.
Because there, you know, there were some ways around it, but it was too late at that point. So there I was without a project with all this time, but I also had collected a lot of data before I left the US for several different projects on student parents. And so I used that time to write out of those projects. I had something I owed to somebody here based on data I collected as a contract. So I wrote a 70-page report based on that. Continued to mentor my graduate students on research from there. And we would have meetings at 9 a.m. for them and 2 p.m. for me, because that was the last time I could meet with them before picking up my kids from school. So I had lots of meetings at the end of my workday every day, but the beginning of everybody's here. So it was like, I am disappointed still, because it was just such a loss and it didn't need to be a loss. And I missed out on learning a lot about the UK context.
Yeah. I mean, that just seems very surprising and unexpected. Like I wouldn't have thought, I guess like a lesson learned would be maybe do like go through the IRB process before you leave. But I guess you wouldn't assume that that they would just tell you no.
Right. And I started the IRB in May. It just, the process was so slow for a variety of different reasons.
Yeah.
So that was frustrating, but also, I mean, as everybody is who goes on a typical sabbatical, I'm tenured and I'm also, you know, people keep saying you're a full professor, it doesn't matter, but it's still frustrating.
Yeah, you still wanted to do that work, right?
Exactly. So I did use the time productively, you know, in the sense of the academy and, you know, in that way, but I also used it productively for myself and my soul, right?
Yeah. Tell me more about that, because I'm all about soul productivity or doing the things that are going to nourish you so that when you come back to work, you actually want to be there and you can kind of make your highest contribution to the institution, your department, your students. So what did you do for yourself on sabbatical?
So I just took time to be a human. Like because we biked everywhere, at drop off in the morning, I would stay and chat with parents, you know, in the bike racks. Mm-hmm. I was able to go to the gym regularly, which was really just important for so many different reasons. It was important for my rehab once I was able to go. And it was, of course, like beautiful. It looked out on a green, like a square in Cambridge with like the beautiful buildings in the distance. And so like I could only literally work until 3:10, and then I would have to get on my bike to get the kids. And so it was just such a different, I mean, it was a different pace of work, that it was really great.
And then you all had time after school to kind of hang out.
So what would we do on Mondays was the play date with their friends. Tuesday, we would bike to gymnastics because I enrolled them in gymnastics there. Mm. Wednesday, we would do things as a family. Thursday, they did an after school sports club. The schools are great there. Like they had different options. So they did that. They also did choir during school and one of them did dance, or both did dance. One did choir. So yes, it was just like, it was refreshing in terms of being out of the day-to-day grind. And I say that with love of, you know, all the emails that come through and the challenges of sort of supporting students. Mm-hmm. I was not in it. I was supporting my doc students, right? I continued to work with students who were writing their dissertations and worked with other students on research, but it was just me focusing on scholarship, and that was, and myself, and that was freeing.
Yeah. And that really allows you to step away at 3:00, right? So you don't have to be scrambling for, oh, I need care. And then you can, one of my clients was talking about how one of her goals for sabbatical is that she wouldn't give her kids just what was left over at the end of the day. And I thought that was such a nice way to think about it, like that you would actually have your energy, your presence to give your kids when they come home from school. And sabbatical offers such a nice opportunity for that because you get to change your pace.
Yeah, it was lovely. It really was. And I'm trying to figure out how do we hold on to some of that here? You know,
yeah,
it's hard.
Have you, come up with any good ideas?
I'm using the weekends very well to do that thing. Yeah. But I went 12 hours yesterday without seeing my kids because I teach in the evenings.
That's hard.
In ed school, right? And I could physically feel it in my body how much I miss them when I hug them. So just trying to figure out ways for us to reconnect. We've rejoined all of our old things. We have a membership to our local YMCA and we swim at the pool a lot. And that is really great for our family. We really love just being silly together.
Yeah. And I don't know about for you, but for my family, I feel like we learned a lot about how we operate as a family by being in a new place together and the things we like to do all together. Because it kind of, you know, when you shift the equilibrium a little bit and everyone has to get comfortable with a new way of being, it kind of helps you figure out just some new things about your family. And so I feel like it's changed our outlook a little bit and the way that we connect together.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. It was such a great experience.
Yeah. What a privilege. Mm-hmm. So I know so many people have questions about, you know, how do you do this with kids and figure out all the logistics? And so I really appreciate all of the insight you gave. And I'm wondering, do you have any sort of words of wisdom or advice to someone planning a sabbatical away, and maybe particularly a sabbatical away with kids?
I would say to start early. I mean, I think that's with any sabbatical, but I think it does get complicated when you're trying to work out whatever the care needs to look like for your children. If they aren't school age, what does that look like? If you don't have a partner who can help with that, what do the schools look like? What does your housing look like? And also, I mean, just like parenting advice when you go anywhere, figure out where the parks are, right? Never have I seen so many parks.
Oh my gosh, that must have been amazing.
It sure was. And so I think really just going for it. A lot of people have said to me here, like, I can't believe you did that. Like, that's amazing that you went by yourself with your kids. And I try and give us all the same wonderful opportunities that one might have regardless of family structure. And so just know that it's possible and it mm-hmm. will be fantastic. Like my kids, as you said earlier, it has changed the way that they relate with the world. One who is a nervous traveler really wants to travel now. They both have different worldviews, I think. And that has been the greatest benefit, honestly. Professionally, it wasn't great for me in that regard, in terms of not getting to do my research. It was a delight for me to get back to the UK because as I mentioned, I lived there for a year as an undergraduate and I did two study abroads. Like summer programs as a graduate student and an undergrad. So like, I love the UK. So it was just nice to be there in that regard. And just really fulfilling something I had wanted to do ever since I became a father. I knew that I wanted to do a real sabbatical abroad rather than my 3 weeks, which was lovely in my first sabbatical. But this was like the immersion that I could afford to give our family.
Yeah. Well, that's so amazing. And I'm so happy for you that you got that. It sounds like just doing the sabbatical was good for your soul, kind of realizing that the thing that you wanted to be able to do and to be able to share it with your daughters. I mean, what a special thing for your family. And who knows where it'll take you all in the future. That's kind of exciting, right?
Exactly. As we talk about, I think I'm eligible again when they're in eighth grade. So they're already lobbying for places to go.
Oh, wow. So it might be a different planning experience this time around.
Yes. Yes, it sure will be, is my guess.
You're going to have to deal with tears of disappointment that they didn't get their first choice, not about the going on sabbatical part.
Exactly. I don't know which is worse.
Oh, well, Margaret, thank you so much. This was so fun and so great to hear all about your sabbaticals and all the advice you have to share. I really appreciate it.
Oh, thanks for allowing me to relive it. It was fun.
I hope you found this episode of Sabbatical 101 helpful and inspirational as you think about your own sabbatical. If you want to read more about sabbaticals or get even more support for planning your own life-changing sabbatical, head over to my website, www.bethanywalinsky.com, to read my blog and for more information about my sabbatical coaching program.